Radio Tokyo is operating on 16 and 19 meter bands. We are here once again to give you another edition of news direct from Tokyo, Japan. But before we go into our news, Radio Tokyo wishes to make an announcement. At the end of our English news, Radio Tokyo will bring you the voices of the American war prisoners who were brought back to Japan from Wake Island. So please stand by until the end of the news. Now for your news in English from Radio Tokyo. From the war front in Malaya, the enemy forces in northwestern area of Labi have started general retreat since Tuesday night, before they feel this fact. Over 6,000 and 1,000 dead bodies were left by the enemy. From a Japanese base in Malaya, after mangling a British defense line, Japanese forces Wednesday night successfully pushed their front to Labi and Bekaa in southern Malaya before they feel this fact Thursday, taking a roundabout way in the southern area of Bekaa. The Japanese effectively cut off the retreating line of the British remnant. Somewhere in Malaya, before the entry into Singapore, the Japanese forces started a series of clean-up operations against mechanized British remnants in Singapore. The British are desperately hurrying final preparations for the defense of Singapore. From a Japanese base in Malaya, 7 Hawker Hurricane fighters were shot down by Japanese continuing. Shanghai. 1/3 of Lower Burma has been occupied by Japan. Shanghai. Japanese mechanized forces crushed the British defense line at the southern front, announced the British authorities at Rangoon Thursday, according to information given the operations around the city of Tavoy in Burma. Burmese forces, which have had strong anti-British sentiment, issued a proclamation Thursday to the 15 million people of Burma and clarified the objective of the present Japanese operation. The proclamation also urged the people of Burma to cooperate with Japan for gaining the independence of Burma. The proclamation reads as follows. The Burmese people should rise and cooperate with Japan, for the Japanese forces advancing to Burma in order to emancipate the Burmese from the yoke of a century-old British imperialism. If Burma cooperates with Japan, Burma will realize its age-long desire for independence. Since the Burmese people are of Asiatic race, and are as devout Buddhists as the Japanese, it is only natural that every Burmese should cooperate with Japan, each in his respective position. The Japanese forces will protect any Burmese who will work together with the Japanese. On the other hand, those who resist the Japanese will be looked upon as an enemy of East Asia. Even those in the past who have been connected with the British or Chinese forces will be treated as a friend of Japan if they renounce their past affiliations and cooperate with Japan. The war for the emancipation of East Asiatic races has begun. Brothers of East Asia, do not be misled by malicious propaganda of the enemy. Rise up for the independence and glory of your fatherland. Now is the time for you to march forward hand in hand with the invincible Japanese forces. The proclamation concluded. From a war base in Burma, crack units of the Japanese Army Air Force, in cooperation with a land unit that advanced into the Burmese territory, conducted a surprise attack on the Moulmein airfield, enemy's advanced air base in Burma, on Tuesday morning, shooting down 2 bombers. A Shanghai dispatch indicates that in view of successive bombing attacks being affected by the Japanese Air Force upon Rangoon, and that Rangoon has been placed in a danger zone as a result of the Japanese entry into Burma, British authorities are planning to remove an official communique issued at 5 o'clock Thursday afternoon. The Imperial Headquarters announced that a squadron of Japanese naval planes shot down or destroyed on the ground a total of 10 planes of the Dutch cornered on the Bataan Peninsula. Japanese forces have completely occupied the strategic port town of Morong on the western coast of the peninsula after a fierce engagement lasting 8 hours, which ended in the hurried retreat of the enemy forces further southward. While fiercely pursuing remnants of the American forces fleeing in the mountainous terrain, Japanese units are pressing toward the southern end of the Bataan Peninsula and now are advancing toward their next objective, a strategic communication center linking the western coast of the peninsula with an important city on Manila Bay. On the Philippine front, railway service was resumed Wednesday between Demarti and Tarlac in central Luzon, following completion of repair work on base at Radio Tokyo, Buenos Aires. According to an announcement made in the United States, a new general offensive by the Japanese forces has been opened against Bataan Peninsula, and the attack against the middle part of the peninsula is the most serious one. Secretary of War Stimson is said to have acknowledged the serious situation the United States Army now finds itself in, stating that due to disadvantageous geographical conditions, as well as lack of airplanes, the United States Army under the command of General MacArthur is now thrown into despair. Evacuation of Philippines. The construction of the destruction of four American fighter planes of the Curtiss T-40 type was disclosed when Japanese planes succeeded in his appreciation for the Curtiss Kiowa. All foreigners residing in the Japanese-occupied town of Kuching in British Borneo are safely engaged in their activities, recently recruiting air freighters to overcome their dire straits, information from London indicates. This final measure taken by the authorities of the British Navy is regarded to add another irreparable cost for the deterioration of the makings of the British Navy personnel. As the range of the bombing attacks by the Japanese Air Force is extended to New Guinea and Northern Australia, the voices of the American war prisoners who were brought back to Japan from Wake Island. First, you will hear Major Paul A. Putnam of Coronado, California.
As a prisoner of war. My home address is Coronado, California. As a prisoner of war as Japan, I have been treated very well. While we remained on watch, we were given good beds, move in, and were well fed on some food, good American food that I was used to, that was captured with us. A good trip on a trip from work, so we found the food, found that I was not used to. Well, it was adequate to me, then I feel that I will get this up and enjoy it just as well as the American form. I've been told that I can send a brief message to my wife and my family. Hello, Joe. I'm alive and well. I'm in minor wounds, which is real well. I'm as happy as I can be without you. Thank you.
You have just heard the voice of Major Paul A. Putnam of Coronado, California. And we now bring you the voice of Robert Shores, first class private of the Marine Corps.
This is Robert Shores, private first class of the Marine Corps, and I wish to convey a message to my mother that I am somewhere in Japan, feeling fine and being well treated by the Japanese, but I hope that we'll all be well and safe and back home soon. And mother, don't worry, because I know we're being treated the best.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just been listening to the voices of the American war prisoners who were brought back to Japan several days ago from Wake Island. Those who spoke today were Major Paul A. Putnam of Coronado, California, and First Class Private Robert Shores of the Marine Corps. This special broadcast will be conducted every day at the close of our English news session. So be sure to tune in to Radio Tokyo. Your loved ones, relatives or friends may be among these American officers and men now in Japan. This is the Broadcasting Corporation of Japan. You have been listening to a program of news and entertainment brought to you through the facilities of the Broadcasting Corporation of Japan. The shortwave broadcast from Tokyo is operating on 16 and 19 meter bands. Next edition of news will be on the air at 12:30 p.m. Tokyo time or 3:30 GMT or 1 hour from now. A Rangoon radio reported Thursday morning that the Japanese forces now operating in Burma advanced to Kokalek Highlands Wednesday afternoon. Kokalek is situated at a point one-third the distance to Moulmein from the Thailand border, some 4,600 feet above the sea level. Shanghai. Japanese mechanized forces crushed the British remnant line at the southern frontier, announced the British authorities at Rangoon Thursday, according to information reaching Shanghai. Fierce fighting are now in progress at a point east of Miyawadi, the announcement added. From a Japanese base, during the operations around the city of Tavoy in Burma, Burmese forces which have had strong anti-British sentiment fully cooperated with the Japanese to annihilate British forces. With the frontal clash started between Japanese and British forces at Tavoy, units of Burmese forces stationed in the rear of the British line suddenly began firing at the British in full concert with the Japanese. After crushing British resistance, the Japanese successfully joined hands with southern Burma. Crack units of the Japanese Army Air Force, in cooperation with the land units that advanced into the Burmese territory, conducted a surprise attack, raided the port of Tawang in northern Malacca, and bombarded an important air base in the port, inflicting heavy damage. The Japanese raiders during the attack blasted back harbor facilities.
From Bandung, reported Monday that the Dutch, British, American, and Australian troops, which surrendered to the Japanese in the Bandung sector and the central part of Java, now total more than 50,000. These include 13,000 in Bandung, 16,000 in Skavumi, 11,000 in Garat and Tasikuma Laja, and 12,000 in Korowogumi. The prisoners of war in the Garat area were disarmed on March 12th by the Japanese forces, which on the same day liberated about 500 Indonesians who had been confined since the outbreak of the war. Asked why they had been held in custody, they said they were regarded as dangerous elements because of pro-Japanese sentiment. Batavia, with the clearing of the passage through the minefields in Java Rasi, the first Japanese vessel to enter the Dutch East Indies port since the...
A Yomiuri dispatch from Bandung reported Monday that the Dutch, British, American, and Australian troops, which surrendered to the Japanese in the Bandung sector and the central part of Java, now total more than 50,000. These include 13,000 in Bandung, 16,000 in Skaverne. There has been little evidence to bear out these claims, largely due to the swiftness of the Japanese advance. The correspondent reported that the one-time capital of the Dutch East Indies is rapidly being restored to normalcy since the Japanese occupation on March 5th. The gas and water services have been resumed, while streetcars have been running since March 10th. All cultural facilities, such as libraries and museums, are left intact, and preparations for their reopening are being hastened. One of the radio stations city resumed its transmission on March 10th with news broadcast in the Dutch and Malayan languages, while the telephone service also had been restored on the same day. The newspaper Equatorial Times made its first appearance on the streets of Batavia, carrying the latest world news in both the Dutch and Japanese languages. Surabaya. With only 6 days elapsing since entry AI 6 concerning regulation governing the Dutch colony, the arrangement provides that firstly, 4,000 Dutch residents in Medan will be confined to their homes, while government officials will be free to attend their duties. Secondly, as soon as the Japanese military administration is established, the Japanese army authorities will dispose of all rights and interests belonging to the Dutch. Meanwhile, Japanese army authorities, while issuing strict instruction against the circulation of all anti-adverse propaganda material, have mobilized 400 armed fleets composed mostly of selected Malayans to maintain peace and order. British and American residents at the time of the Japanese occupation numbered 20, all of whom have been arrested and interned by the Japanese. Medan, civilian from Guam. He is a secretary. And his address? 1401 Wall Street, Berkeley, California. Hello, Mother. So this is Alinda Hardy. 1800 East Street, Lincoln, Nebraska. Hello to Miss Betty Blum. B-L-E-T-H-E-N, Blum. 650 Bush Street, San Francisco, California. And Mr. and Mrs. Paul E. Hardy. 1401 Wall Street, Berkeley, California. Please dispel your worries and fears. I am quite well and as happy as circumstances permit. I was taken at Guam on December 10th and a month later moved to Japan. I am now lodged at Kobe with other civilians from Guam. The Japanese have shown us every courtesy and consideration possible to our well-being, and I am indeed grateful for this opportunity to get in touch with you. The food has been excellent, plenty of reading material provided, and we are allowed to exercise twice daily in a nearby park. In the rapid change from a tropical Guam to Japan's midwinter weather, I caught my usual cold, but recovered in short order and am now in good shape, mentally and physically. Our main hopes are for an early exchange of nationals. Word from home and that the Red Cross will show up with some American tobacco and candy. Hope you are all well and happy and will take good care of yourselves until I return. Will whoever receives this message please contact the others and my friends? Please write toward them home that we are here and would like very much to come home. It is hoped that we'll be seeing you soon. Now to you all. Signed, Kenneth F. Hardy. Next is from Chambers. Lee F. Chambers. C-H-A-M-B-E-R-S. Age 41, a civilian from Guam. He is a foreman, and his address is 871 Kirk Street, San Francisco, California. It is addressed to Mrs. Dorothy Chambers, wife, same address. Hello, darling. I am in Kobe, Japan, and well, and hope there will be some deal made that we can get home soon. Keep your chin up, honey. Also, I want to say hello to Jack, W.F. Chambers, in Petaluma, California, and my brother, Howard Chambers, my sister, Mrs. H.B. Moore, San Francisco, California, Bob Gerhardt, and Jim Ward, also all local 216 material drivers, San Francisco, California. And a big hello and cheerio to my best friend, Dick Ward, 823 Florida Street, Valley Old, California. See that everything is okay. Best regards to Bud and Marion and boys. 67 Ford Street, San Francisco, California. Also to Mr. and Mrs. C. J. Williams and Miss Vera Martin, 852 Miller Avenue, South San Francisco, California. Best regards to all my friends in the state. Love and kisses to Dorothy Chambers. Hope to see you soon. Lee F. Next is from Mr. White. Alton Royce White. Age 26, civilian from Guam. His address is Roland, R-O-L-E-W-T-E, North Dakota. It is addressed to Mrs. Roy White, Roland, North Dakota. Dear Mother and Dad, I came through the trouble okay, and am now interned here in Japan safe and well, and in perfect health and being treated very well by the Japanese here. We do not know how long we will be here, but are hoping for an exchange of nationals between United States and Japan, so we may come home soon. Please do not worry, as I am okay. We are all grateful to the Japanese government for their kindness and considerate treatment, and hope that if our internment is to be as long we may get in touch with our American Red Cross so that we may receive whiskey, cigarettes, and warm shirts. Signed, your son, Alton Royce White.
That is the keynote of the news in all Australian newspapers today. The threat of a Japanese landing in New Guinea, the bombing of Rabaul, and the pressure of the Japanese advance in Malaya have brought the Axis blitz within striking distance of the main populated centres of Australia. In a rallying call to Australians, Deputy Prime Minister Ford says, quote, "The time has arrived when the government expects every Australian man and woman to take up his or her place at a battle station, whether at work in a vital munitions factory or in Australia's fighting services. It is well that the public should realise the seriousness of the full-scale military assault on New Guinea. If successful, it would probably result in bases being established from which the Australian mainland would be attacked. It is the plain duty of the Australian people to prepare for any eventuality and to do everything humanly possible to speed up the production of arms, munitions, coal, and equipment, all of which are so vitally necessary today. The government realizes the seriousness of the threat to Australia and with courage and determination will take whatever steps are necessary. We must now ensure the wholehearted cooperation of all sections, and everything must now be subordinated to the national interest." Unquote. A few hours ago, Deputy Prime Minister Ford, in the temporary absence of the Prime Minister, conferred with the chiefs of the three services. Every hour throughout the day, members of the War Cabinet have kept in close touch with the latest information from the near north. This morning, Air Minister Drakeford gave the Australian public the latest details of Japanese bombing. The Air Minister said, quote, "It's obvious from the operation that the Japanese have more than one aircraft carrier, supported by covering naval forces and shore-based aircraft off the Bismarck Archipelago. It's not unexpected that an enemy landing would be affected in the New Guinea area today. I issue a warning that the enemy may be expected to launch a full-scale military assault on New Guinea with the object of securing bases from which to attack the Australian mainland. We must prepare ourselves for any eventuality. Little further information has been received from the areas in New Guinea attacked yesterday by the enemy. In certain cases, there is reason to believe that the Japanese may have temporarily put out of action wireless telegraph stations at the point of attack. Reports to hand indicate that a night air attack was made on Gorolo by fighters which destroyed several civil aircraft on the ground. Some civil aircraft also were destroyed on the ground at Salamaua. Only slight damage was reported, and information received suggests that several people have been injured. About 9 o'clock this morning, Eastern Australian summertime, a number of Japanese aircraft renewed their attack on Rabaul. Further details are awaited." Unquote. While the Japanese blitzkrieg draws closer, Australia's defence machinery turns steadily and speedily towards victory. Australia's holiday next Monday is cancelled for munition workers. Australia's air raid workers are testing their efficiency. Australia's fighting services are hosts of free men defending their homeland, determined to keep the automatons of Japan at bay. "The threat to our own cities and coasts has become immediate and obvious," says tonight's Melbourne Herald, which adds, quote, "On the speed with which the Allies can achieve organized, aggressive counteraction will depend whether the Pacific War must deteriorate further before Japan can be finally checked," unquote. The Melbourne Herald points out that Japan's tactics are evidently inspired by the realization that it can neither consolidate nor maintain its own lengthy and precarious lines of communication until the strategic coordination of the Allies is completely disrupted. For this reason, the enemy is concentrating on the destruction of Allied positions, which could be potentially developed as bases or points of contact. This brings Australia right into the front line. The number of operational schools in Australia to give young airmen much-needed experience in advanced flying methods will be increased immediately. A government spokesman explains that at one of the new schools, air crews will be trained in navigation for flights over long stretches of water. Prime Minister Curtin has flatly denied a report that the recall of outstanding Australian pilots now attached to air squadrons in Great Britain is being discussed. War Prime Minister says that Australia is not short of trained airmen. This news bulletin comes to you from Australia. Full battle kit, identical with that issued to the Australian Imperial Forces serving abroad, has been issued to Australia's Home Defence Forces. Army Minister Ford says that the Home Defence Forces are now regarded as troops in the field. Therefore, they must have additional items, such as respirators, anti-gas tapes and tubes, anti-gas ointments, gas detectors, and gas warning signs. As the Army, Navy, and Air Departments check their fighting kit, so the Home Security Department tests the plans for civilian protection. Home Security Minister Lazzarini says that the issue of steel helmets to air raid personnel will be increased by 400% immediately. First distribution will be in vulnerable, threatened areas. In every state of the Commonwealth, ARP measures are keeping step with the accelerated pressure of the federal authorities. Prime Minister John Curtin has gone home to Perth in Western Australia to see his family for the first time since August. During the few days' release from pressure of official business, Mr. Curtin will attend the wedding of former Angus Field Gray, who once acted as copy boy when Mr. Curtin was editor of a West Australian newspaper. Mr. Curtin has crashed into this wedding by accident. Journeying home by the famous Transcontinental East-West Express, he was accosted by a bronze young soldier of the AIS Armoured Division. "I don't suppose you remember me, Mr. Curtin?" asked the soldier. "Oh, yes, I do. You're Sidney Gray." Mr. Curtin shot his reply back unhesitatingly. "I remember you when you were a small boy in short pants in the newspaper office." Corporal Gray admitted that he was on leave to be married, and with typical Australian democratic frankness, he invited his former chief to the wedding festival. Mr. Curtin accepted at once, and Corporal Gray said, "Mr. Curtin hasn't changed a bit in all these years." Australia's shipbuilding industry is being planned not only to meet the demands of the war for freedom, but to fulfill the dreams of the post-war era. Navy Minister Makin sees the day when Australian-built ships, manned by Australian crews, will carry Australian produce to all the markets of the world. The Navy Minister is confident that merchant shipbuilding on Australia is being rapidly developed and effectively developed on a permanent basis. In time, it will fulfill what he considers to be the fundamental role, the foundation from which a stronger, protective navy will arise. Australia's shipbuilding industry will be accelerated until the Commonwealth's objective of one vessel a month is reached after 12 months. This will mean launching 60 vessels of the major merchant class in 5 years. And so, Australia, menaced by bombing on the northern coastline, proceeds calmly, courageously, and realistically to meet today's dangers and tomorrow's hopes. Our Home Security Minister typifies this feeling in his message today. He says, quote, "We must keep up war production at all costs, and women folk can play a big part in that directly and indirectly. British and Russian women stood up to bombing, and I believe Australian women, the mothers and sisters and wives of the men in the Australian forces, will have just as much courage. General evacuation of the civilian population is unnecessary unless an invasion takes place. Commonwealth plans cover every contingency. There is appropriate shelter protection, but we don't want the population buried underground in deep shelters or hidden away inland." Unquote. As a Melbourne newspaper says, "Australians can take it. With nothing more than that good human grumbling which is the privilege of every citizen of a race of free people." That's the end of the news from Australia. And in the following commentary, Raymond Watts discusses the significance of the Japanese attack on Rabaul and tells you about Australia's administration of her New Guinea mandate. The talk is read by Arthur Dibley. Until recently, New Guinea has been the happy hunting ground for adventurers, planters, anthropologists, and novelists. Many people still know little about it, except that it has 10 headhunters and pygmies, birds of paradise, and gold. This week, however, it has hit the headlines because of the bombing of Rabaul. On Tuesday, there was a big raid by 100 Japanese aircraft on Rabaul, And yesterday morning, at least 60 enemy planes attacked other places in the Bismarck archipelago. This means another step in the spiritual advance of the Japanese. This is the first direct threat to Australian-controlled territory. It's an attempt to cut off Australia from Singapore and our Dutch allies. There are many reasons why Japan would like to control the country. Strategically, it's of great importance in the Battle of the Pacific. New Guinea lies just north of Australia, a little below the equator to the south of the Japanese-controlled Caroline Islands. Already the Royal Australian Air Force has bombed Greenwich Island in the Caroline. New Guinea and its adjacent islands are thus, geographically, Australia's boundary with Japan. The main island of New Guinea is big, in fact the biggest in the world, roughly a third of a million square miles. On this mainland there are fever-ridden swamps, dense tropical jungles, and great mountain ranges with peaks as high as 30,000 feet. Its rainfall is almost phenomenal, about 200 inches a year. Two great rivers, the Fly and the Sil, find their tortuous way for 700 miles through the Great Mountains. These two rivers empty into the ocean enough water to provide 250 gallons a day for every inhabitant of the globe. It is these mountain ranges and the very heavy rainfall which make most of the difficulties for settlers and explorers. In some places, men can communicate with one another across a gorge which would take a day's journey to cross. One of the main goldfields is only 30 miles from Panama, but it used to take 8 or 10 days or even longer to go from one of these points to the other. Until New Guinea Airways made its aerodrome and started regular air services for passengers and mails and heavy freight. The story of that airline is a story of modern science and intrepid airmen overcoming difficulties that seemed insuperable. The natives themselves are of many races. In the mandated section of New Guinea, there are nearly 600,000 natives. In Papua, there are about 200,000. They include Melanesians, Micronesians, and South Polynesians, who range from portly natives to pygmies. Some of their curious customs and rites are believed by certain anthropologists to carry back to the ancient Phoenicians. Some of them still live in the Stone Age and have never been a white man. The part played by Asiatics in the exploration of New Guinea is obscure, but old Chinese coins have been found in the dark hinterlands. In more modern times, many nations have contributed to the discovery, exploration, and colonization of the islands. New Britain and New Ireland were known by William Dampier, the Englishman. Australia gave New Guinea, prophetically, the name Isla del Oro, Island of Gold. The Dutch did most to open up the west of the main island, and they still administer that part of their Netherlands East India Empire. Since 1905, the southeastern section, Papua, has been controlled by the Australian government. The northeastern section, the part now being heavily raided by Japanese planes, was captured by Australian troops from the Germans in September 1914. Ever since 1920, it's been administered by Australia under mandate from the League of Nations as a C-class mandate. The story of this trustee ship is one that will bear inspection. Despite some mistakes which were inevitable during the early years of the mandate, it's a story of sincere efforts by many conscientious officials to develop the country and at the same time to safeguard the interests of the natives. There are hardly 6,000 white persons in all throughout the mandated territory in Papua. But amongst them, almost every country in Europe is represented, as well as America. In this cosmopolitan country of planters and gold diggers, missionaries and recruiters of native labour, there have been some whose primary interest was not always the interest of the natives. Such people have learned, however, that the government regards the mandate as a solemn trust and tries strenuously to promote the welfare of the natives. A school of anthropology was opened at Sydney University, mainly for the purpose of providing trained university graduates to study the customs of the natives and to safeguard their rights. It's been said by a resident of the mandated territory of New Guinea that the League of Nations worked magic in the territory because set kids would almost certainly be brought to the notice of the Mendes Commissioner of Geneva. It's interesting to note that a few years ago there was a proposal to combine the administration of Papua and New Guinea. The special committee which investigated the proposal decided against it. One of the main reasons was that nothing should be done which would even appear to encroach upon Australia's international obligations regarding the Mendes.